Hello and welcome to another spooky episode of Saved by the 90s. My name's Adam Patterson. With me today is a guy whose second favorite author is Stephen King, second only to Richard Bachman, Mr. Ken Bakely. Hey, Ken.
Hello. You know, I was thinking about this and I thought I've read a few Stephen King short stories here and there, but I don't think I think the only book of his that I actually own is On Writing, which is his memoir, which is weird.
That's interesting.
Like, I've read some of his stuff here and there, but I guess I've never bought any of it. Like, I've maybe gone to a library or something, but
yeah,
I have On Writing.
When I was young, when I was like a kid and I was like super, super into reading, I had a whole bunch of Stephen King books, but I honestly don't know if I ever read one in its entirety. There was one, it was a collection of short stories. I can't remember which one. It was for the famous, probably his most famous one, whatever that was. But
also,
I read that.
His novels can be really long, too.
Right, yeah. They were always really intimidating for me as like a 12-year-old or whatever.
Yeah.
But since then, I've resorted to just listening to his books on audio. Mm-hmm. All right, so in case you didn't figure it out, this month for Halloween, we're going to be talking about four 90s released Stephen King adaptations. There was actually significantly more than that we could have picked from. Stephen King had a very good output of adaptations in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So there were plenty to choose from, but
after a point in time, there isn't no shortage of Stephen King adaptations at any point.
No. And they're all, I think they're all special in their own way. Like all of them, and we'll get into it more in more detail with each one of these, but even when they're not good movies, they're still kind of good. Like, I still, as long as they're able to retain that Stephen King like vibe, that charm that he injects into his stories, I think that it works even when the movie's not very good. And I think that does apply to one or more of the ones that we're going to be talking about today.
I would go so far as to posit that if we're talking about seriously very good movies this month, there's only one that I would call that.
there is one, yes. And it happens to be the first one that we're going to talk about. Probably one of King's biggest movies that was released in the 90s, and that's Misery from 1990. It's directed by Rob Reiner. I have a synopsis here. After a famous author is rescued from a car crash by a fan of his novels, he comes to realize that the care he is receiving is only the beginning of a nightmare of captivity and abuse. Now, this is the third time I've seen Misery. I actually just rewatched this maybe a couple years ago and enjoyed it immensely. I remember when I was a kid, I didn't see this as a kid because it was rated R and I wasn't old enough to see it. But I do remember the hype around this movie. And I remember my parents saw it and they were so deeply disturbed by it. And this was a huge, huge movie. Kathy Bates, who stars alongside James Caan, she won an Academy Award for her role in this. She's pretty great.
Yeah, it's great that this was a movie that was recognized to be good at the time, even by the studio, it looks like, because they put it out during award season. Like, recognizing that they had just an astonishing performance here from Kathy Bates and that they were... and that she won the Oscar for what was really one of her first major film roles. She had supporting roles, but I think she was mostly known for doing theater before this, and she really wasn't known as a film actor. So this was one of her first major film roles, and she won one of the most prestigious awards in film for a very great performance. I've seen this movie a couple of times. Probably not too much all the way through, but I've seen parts of it a lot because, like, I feel like even when I was younger, when you tend to rewatch stuff more, I didn't rewatch a lot of movies. But this was one of the ones that I would just, like, watch parts of it a lot and, like, try and piece it apart and trying to figure out what makes it work almost because it is so affecting and kind of really well made, just even within its parameters. So I've long been fascinated by this movie, but I hadn't seen it in its entirety, start to finish in one sitting. Really, maybe more than, I think also maybe twice before this.
Yeah, it's a great film. It works on several levels. You do have that kind of Stephen King charm in here, but the interesting thing is it's a little bit different. Like most of the King hallmarks or tropes are kind of here, but it's kind of stripped down because the film is mostly just about James Caan and Kathy Bates. It's mostly set in her house. If you're not familiar with the details of this movie, James Caan is like basically Stephen King. I mean, he kind of writes himself into all or a lot of his books, but he's a really famous author. He finished his latest book, and he is kind of tired of writing this series, and he plans on killing off the main character. And he gets in a car crash, and Kathy Bates turns out to be an obsessive fan, and which is also kind of interesting, because watching this, a movie that was came out in 1990, I don't know when the book was published, but it's kind of an interesting look at like fandom, in a way, because I feel like today in 2022, fandom has blown up to astronomical levels that are even higher than like what it was back then. I also can't imagine like a person doing this over an author. Like, I feel like nowadays it'd be like a TikTok star or something. Can you imagine? It's instead of James Caan, it's like Bryce Hall or one of those TikTok famous people.
Is that a real person? I don't know TikTok people.
I think so.
I that's the thing. It's like the first major like social media thing that's just completely passed me by. So I don't even know who any of the. Well, I think I must know who some of the people are. But yeah, that's been one of the interesting readings that's come about, especially in the last several years. I think there are a lot of interesting readings, and a lot of them maybe come down to this idea. Of these specific dynamics at play here between these characters. I know Stephen King, in talking about the novel, which was published, I think maybe 86 or 87 or somewhere in that time frame, that was around the time that he was really, that I think he became sober because he had been dealing with drug addiction for some years and struggling with substance abuse. And he said that kind of Misery, the book, was a metaphor for that, with Annie Wilkes character kind of representing addiction. Mm. But then even in that case, like you said, there is, you know, we think about authors and how they represent characters and how artists represent characters. And even in that case, it's still very much, he creates a character who is an author. And even in that reading, the author still represents him.
Mm-hmm. I think the Misery is a great example of what makes Stephen King just such a prolific storyteller, and someone who just continues to put out just amazing piece after amazing piece. I mean, it's just all of his stories are at least somewhat interesting in what they have to say. And I think that a lot of that is due to the character work. I mean, you have Misery. It's a horror movie. I mean, or more of a thriller, but there's like some pretty disturbing elements in here, and it's a creepy movie, but at the same time, and this can be said about all the movies that we're going to be talking about this month and pretty much all of the Stephen King adaptations across the board, is that there's this like level of comedy it sort of injected into everything, or where there's like this layer of dark comedy in almost all of his stories. And I think that's one of the things that makes them so kind of intriguing.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing that you don't think about until you come back and rewatch.
Yeah, you don't.
This is a much funnier movie.
Yeah, you forget about that. Like you forget about the little like the one-liners and just the reactions of James Caan, who is, you know, playing off of Annie Wilkes, Kathy Bates' character. He's like the straight man. He's like the normal guy, and she's a complete nut from the very beginning, and he's just trying to deal with her craziness and make it through this situation that he finds himself in. And it's very funny at a lot of times. Like there's it's very, very funny. And I think that people forget about that because there's certain things that overshadow that, like the hobbling scene, which is
yes.
You can't talk about Misery and not talk about the hobbling scene.
That scene is not, in fact, funny.
No, it is not. But it is a very iconic scene. I think that even people who haven't seen this movie are aware of that scene. It's like one of those moments. And it's great. God, I love you.
I think... I rewatched this movie and I bought it for pretty cheap on iTunes. And when you buy it, it comes with some of the extras that would be on like the DVD and the Blu-ray release. And I listened to a bit of Rob Reiner's director's commentary for it. William Goldman, the screenwriter, also did one, but I never got around to listening to any of that, but I haven't. So if I ever am so inclined, I can do so. But Rob Reiner's commentary is pretty interesting because in the parts that I've listened to, he talked a lot just about there was this idea of expectation, because he directs this movie right after When Harry Met Sally, and mm-hmm. just generally speaking, he had not done a movie that you could classify as thriller or horror before. So there was this feeling that maybe he wasn't the best director for this material. There was a lot of scrutiny about that. And so he talks a lot about just that process of researching. He watched a bunch of Hitchcock movies. But another thing that I thought was even more interesting was talking about, this movie is shot by Barry Sonnenfeld, who would go on to direct a lot of movies.
Adam's Family.
And they talk, and Reiner talks about just the challenge of the fact that, as you mentioned, this movie not only takes place largely, almost exclusively in Annie Wilkes' house, but large parts of it take place within like the spare bedroom that Paul Sheldon is put up in. So it was about that challenge of trying to figure out different ways to shoot that room, so it did not just feel like you were kind of running out of ways to shoot that room, and showing how the dynamics change and become more menacing, and how the information we get sort of changes the general perception of what's going on. But just in the challenges of just trying to film in one room, and they spent weeks filming in that room. It sounds like they shot this movie somewhat sequentially from what he was saying. And how excited everyone was apparently when there's that first time that Paul Sheldon's able to sneak out of the room,
mm-hmm.
and how happy the crew was to actually get that one shot of the hallway, because it was like the first time in weeks they had shot anything except that room.
I think that goes to show you how good of a director Rob Reiner is and how good Barry Sonnenfeld is, because I've seen a ton of movies that are these like one location movies. I mean, especially since COVID, I feel like we've been getting a lot of these movies that feature very few actors and very minimal, like sets and stuff, you know, very, very small production designs. And, it's hard. Like it adds a layer of challenge. You would think that it'd perhaps be easier because you have fewer locations and less probably lighting issues and things like that, but to make it interesting for audiences, I think is a whole new challenge, because if the entire movie is set in one spot, everything hinges on the performances and the camera work, making it look interesting while being in a pretty bland bedroom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this movie does it way better than a lot of movies that are working with more.
Mm-hmm.
It just it never feels like you're sort of just stuck there. It always feels more open than it actually is.
Definitely, definitely.
You're a dirty birdie.
It's very good dialogue in this.
Oh yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I think we'd be remiss not to mention Richard Farnsworth and Frances Sternhagen in their supporting.
That just goes along with the comedy aspect. Yeah. I mean,
yes.
Like, those two characters feel like such quintessential King characters to me.
Yes.
I love their dynamic. I love their banter. They were so great. They were perfect additions to this movie, and they needed to be in this movie. Like, I think that if you take them out, this movie does not work nearly as well as it does.
I think so. Yeah.
They're fantastic. Great movie. Starting off with the best, and then now I guess we're gonna start to work our way down a little bit here. Was there anything else you wanted to add about Misery?
I read two observations. I saw a pretty, I think, telling fact about maybe one of the challenges of getting this movie made, especially to cast Paul Sheldon's part, which is that it seems like there are some conflicting reports, but it seems like Kathy Bates was the only like person they were seriously pursuing for this role, for as Annie Wilkes. But for Paul Sheldon, it took a long time to cast that part. They offered it to a lot of A-list leading men in Hollywood at the time, and a lot of them turned it down for a very interesting reason. Like, they went to Warren Beatty, they went to Robert Redford, to a lot of different people, and allegedly one of the reasons that some of them turned it down was because they had a hard time getting an A-list male lead to be in a movie where they are not really the lead character. Like, they just did not like this idea that they were going to play a character who is so much, you know, the viewer's eyes, but at the whim of another character. Like, and or someone who's literally lying down for large chunks of the movie. And it was very difficult to get a major male lead to agree to play this part for what I think is let's just say interesting reasons.
A little bit of that classic Hollywood misogyny.
Yeah, I think so. It really seems. There have been some interesting readings on the way that gender dynamics are presented in this story, which I think seem that much more cogent once you encounter that fact. That it took them ages to cast Paul Sheldon for just that very direct reason that a lot of them were like, I don't like that I'm not actually the lead who's in control the entire time.
I'm just imagining Warren Beatty like, I don't like that.
Yeah.
I'm Warren Beatty. I shouldn't play second fiddle to Kathy Bates, some no name. I'm Warren Beatty.
I guess that's what happened.
Yeah, that was his. That was exactly what he said.
That's a quote
by Warren Beatty. Yeah, but then James Caan stepped up to the plate and delivered a great performance.
Yeah.
Legend. All right, moving on. We're next going to be talking about one that I've never seen before, but it's been on my list forever. And I was actually planning on watching it this Halloween anyway, so it all worked out. Sleepwalkers is what we're talking about. This is directed by Mick Garris. This one is written by Stephen King. He wrote the screenplay.
Or the screen, no adaptation.
Correct. Have a synopsis here. A mother and son team of strange supernatural creatures move to a small town to seek out a young virgin to feed on. I feel like this would have probably worked better if it was an adaptation. I feel like the fact that it was written for the screen hindered it in some way. I can't fully say what that was, but something about this one was lacking.
I know Stephen King's done some screenwriting, but this is the only one I've seen, and he does not strike me as a natural screenwriter.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like it's just... I feel like his characters have a lot of depth in his books, but in this movie, there wasn't that much. There wasn't that that it factor with this one.
I don't know how to describe it, but you can absolutely tell that this is him writing the dialogue for the screen and not someone else adapting his writing and his characters.
Yeah, it's just not as good. It's just not as good as what the normal output is for him. Now, that being said, while I don't think that this is a good movie, I still had fun with it. Like, it was ridiculous. Like,
oh, did this? I mean, yeah,
it was utterly ridiculous. From right out the gate, let's just talk about the relationship between this mother and son, because they're more than just mother and son, and they drop that bomb on you right at the beginning, and you're just like, wait, what are they? Oh, okay, we're going.
Stephen King does not waste 10 minutes putting us in this position.
Yeah. Like, okay, we're going there with it. All right, sure. So yeah, you have this quote unquote mother and son team, and they move into this little town and I guess to like stay young, the mom needs to like suck out souls or something. And they're these like weird, they kind of look like cats, but the interesting thing is like cats can see them and like hurt them, like really bad hurt them. Like,
yeah,
cats can like straight up kill them very easily. like one little scratch from a cat and they're dead, which is kind of weird.
Yeah,
and yet they themselves sort of look like cat people. They're shapeshifters, and apparently there's some kind of lore that they get into about these sleepwalkers, and like, I don't know if it's like real, like fantasy lore, or if it's just all made up by Stephen King, but it's not that interesting. But there's some fun moments in this. It's not particularly good looking on a visual level. It almost looks like one of Stephen King's TV adaptations, actually. It's kind of looks like it's on that level, but they play Anya multiple times, so
they do.
There you go.
They do, in fact.
If you're looking for a movie that's got Anya multiple times, then Sleepwalkers, that's it. That's your jam right there.
Also, many increasingly on the nose invocations of Sleepwalk, the 50s instrumental piece.
Yes, which is, yeah, that's annoying. But
yeah, in case you didn't get it the first time.
The characters in this are so bizarre. Like, they're just utterly bizarre characters. You have Alice Krieg here as Mary Brady. She's the mom. And then you have Brian Krause as the son / lover. And like, the mom never leaves the house. I'm not sure why. Did they even mention like why she just stays in and has the son do everything?
Doesn't want to come across any cats for,
I guess. I guess that's what it is.
Extremely serious reasons, as we find out.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is. But the son, he's in high school, and he ends up meeting this girl played by Majkin Amick, probably mispronouncing that, but she's in Riverdale. Yeah. She's in Twin Peaks. You know exactly.
Yes.
You'll know who I'm talking about if I say Riverdale and Twin Peaks. She's great. I love her. She is. So she's like sort of the love interest. She works at a movie theater, and the weird thing is, like, she's immediately all over this guy. like right out of the gate, just all over him. It's kind of weird how quickly she goes after this guy.
Even though the character, even if you didn't know who he was, still has very off-putting energy.
He does. He's a very off-putting gentleman. And you, at first, you think like, oh, maybe he's like reluctant. Maybe he's just like he's a shapeshifter. He has to appease his mom. He's got to do this stuff. But then he just starts killing people, like for really no reason. Like he just straight up murders people.
Extremely violent and predatory without any remorse at all.
Yeah. So quickly you're like, okay, well, not only is he not the main character anymore, but he's turned into the antagonist. And it's very messy.
It's all over the place.
Very messy. Mm-hmm. But one of the most interesting things is the number of cameos that you have in this. Because you have cameos from John Landis, Joe Dante, Stephen King, Clive Barker, and Toby Hooper.
We may mention Toby Hooper again this month.
Yeah. Yeah, a little foreshadowing there. So yeah, maybe that's maybe the most interesting. And the Stephen King, the role that he plays, the cemetery caretaker, like that scene with him is so long, like way too long, because it's just goofy.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem with this movie. There's too much happening in this movie, but also it should not be 1 minute longer.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say about it. As far as King movies go, it is, I think, fun, but it's just not on the same level as most of his things. So
it gets sufficiently chaotic at points in the third act in a way that kind of feels fun and in a cohesive way. And I mainly mention this because I did want to point out there's a scene in this movie where someone gets stabbed to death with the corn on the cob.
Yeah.
And I wanted to point out for listeners last month's episode, I have to assume this is also what happens if you run afoul of the Loyal Order of Corn.
Most likely, yeah.
What state is Sleepwalker set in?
Indiana. Very interesting.
Exactly.
Huh. There might be something there. There might be a connection there.
Mick, so does this take place in the eerie Indiana universe?
I don't know. Maybe Mick Garris was onto something there. I just checked because it seems like he'd be like someone who'd be involved in eerie Indiana. Because
I would, yeah,
you know, because Joe Dante was, and he like is in that kind of that crowd, but he was not. He did do this. Yeah. He did do The Stand though, the miniseries, the original miniseries from 1994.
Yeah, it somehow feels like like McGarris should have like have directed a couple of episodes of Eerie Indiana, but
yeah, he did The Stand, he did The Shining TV miniseries, which I remember being very bad. He did Tales from the Crypt, Freddy's Nightmares, which I just recently started watching on Tubi. Man, I wish Freddy's Nightmares came out in the 90s, because that would have been a great one to talk about. It's such a bizarre show.
I'm looking it up now. It appears that the last handful of episodes aired in 1990.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, because it's two seasons, I think. Is it two seasons or is it more?
It's two seasons of 22 episodes each, and the last, like, half of season two aired in 1990. So maybe we could do the last 11 episodes of Freddy's Nightmares.
There you go.
We can do the 1990 episodes.
That would actually be very funny. We should write that down.
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
I think that would be fun. Because it's an anthology series for the most part. So it's not like we'd have to watch all the ones before it or even talk about those.
Good one to keep in mind.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add about Sleepwalkers?
Nah, that's about it, and I might have less to say as we go on.
Yeah.
I got really excited to talk about Misery, and now it's like, good grief, I have to talk about the Dark Half.
Yeah, the Dark Half. So I never saw this one either. This is directed by George A. Romero, which is makes it even more interesting that I never saw it before, because I'm a pretty big Romero fan. This came out in 1993. I have a synopsis here. Writer's fictional alter ego wants to take over his life at any price. This features Timothy Hutton. I think the problem that I have with this one is that it's maybe back in 93 when this came out, or whenever the novel was originally written, maybe it was a more unique story. But for me, this, I felt like I've just kind of seen this movie before, and I just wasn't that into it. I don't like, I've said this on the regular podcast, I might have said it on here, but I don't like movies that involve like split personalities or people who we as the audience are trying to figure out if they're like crazy or whatever. Like that movie Identity, I hated that movie. Like there's just so many of these types of movies, and maybe this one is a little bit different in how the Dark Half, as it were, like how that came about, or like how it's represented sort of in this. But I don't know that, what was the name of the, it was a recent, was it a James Wan film that came out recently?
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Malignant.
I think that Malignant is kind of the same as this, but Malignant does it way better.
Like I liked Malignant.
The reveal in Malignant was like,
yes,
that's how you, if you're going to do a movie like that, that's how you do it. You give them something that nobody could see that coming. In this movie, you just have Timothy Hutton as a writer, and there's this like this pseudonym that he writes under, and
I wonder how Stephen King was inspired to consider this dynamic in an author.
Well, the interesting thing, I read this on the Wikipedia for Richard Bachman. Richard is a tribute to crime author Donald E. Westlake's long-running pseudonym Richard Stark. The surname Stark was later used in King's novel The Dark Half, in which an author's malevolent pseudonym, George Stark, comes to life. There.
Yeah. How long did he get away with using the Richard Bachman pen name? Because, I don't know, I guess maybe we say this now just because we're, you know, so many decades into Stephen King's preeminence in the culture, but it feels like, I'm not sure how he could have a second author supposedly going around with a different name writing in this Stephen King style, which is pretty distinctive.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many years did he get away with it? Or was it just always people were kind of like humoring him for a while?
I think they figured it out after like the first four books. But they figured it out pretty quickly. I mean, he wrote under that name from 77 to 85, but then he was discovered in 87, I think. And then he, in 96, he released The Regulators under the Bachman name, and then in 2007, Blaze. And, you know, Some of the movies, or some of the books, are pretty famous now, like The Running Man and Thinner. I mean, those both got adapted. But anyway, back to
the... Yeah, I feel like it's really indicative that we've almost subconsciously been avoiding talking about this movie.
Timothy Hutton, I think that the problem, one of the problems I have with this is that I just don't see him as a leading man. Like, I just don't think he
has... No, this is a bad casting choice.
He just doesn't have what it takes to carry a movie like this, unfortunately. Like, that's the thing that really held this one of the things that held this movie back was Timothy Hutton.
And if you don't have a very strong lead, you also have a problem that since they have to do so much and since there's so much going on with this movie, that you just risk getting completely lost in it. Like, it's just sort of, it feels like everything in this movie is just floating around. And that's in part because it is 2 hours long for reasons that I do not understand.
Yeah, this is a messy movie too. Holy cow. This is a movie that just it has no idea what it wants to be. Like, the opening is bonkers. You have a kid who is having these, like, they're not headaches, but he's like hearing birds. He's hearing sparrows, and it's like overwhelming him. It's like debilitating. And so they cut his skull open and they find a fully formed moving eyeball, teeth, and a nose, and maybe some other stuff. And the funny thing about that whole scene, first of all, it is a showcase of the excellent makeup work in this movie. Like,
there's some very good makeup
work. The special effects in this movie, although there's not a lot of them, when they do effects work, it's very good. Like, top-notch stuff here. The doctor who discovers this is like, oh yeah, that's just an eyeball growing in his
head. It's like it's such a weird reaction.
So nonchalant about discovering this. I mean, like, even if he understands what it is, like, oh, it was a twin and he absorbed the twin and the eyeball started to grow again, like, that is like a medical marvel right there.
Yeah,
and the doctor should be losing his mind, because even if
there is someone there who has a completely normal reaction to seeing.
And they scold her for it, too. They're like,
why are you acting like this is something unusual?
Be professional. Yeah.
And but like, the two extremes, like, the other extreme end of the reaction is it's just so like a bizarre reaction, because it's like the doctor is like, this is a little bit unusual, but obviously not that unusual.
Yeah.
Like, you can't let on that it's unusual if you're going to start on this.
It's crazy. And then, so you have this really bonkers opening, and you think, oh man, this movie's going to go nuts. I'm excited for this.
Anytime the birds come out, the sparrows come out in this movie, it's great.
Yeah. The problem is most of it is just Timothy Hutton moping around trying to, I guess, stop his dark half from murdering people in his life. And the reason that, so I guess the backstory here is that this alter ego came out and helped him wrote this novel, this book series. I guess it was kind of like a trashy, like, pulp type of series. And it got him a lot of money. It made him famous, blah, blah, blah. And he wrote it all under this pen name. So he kind of stayed hidden. And then he wrote stuff that he wanted to write, and he taught and all of this stuff. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, in terms of talking about, like, the Stephen King, writing about authors who start to write what they want to write after writing something they didn't like that made them successful, This is the vastly inferior take on this compared to Misery. Like, that's the whole thing. Misery starts out, he's finally written the book that he wants to write before everything happens. And it's
the funny thing about the Richard Bachman thing with King wasn't that, like, he was writing under a pseudonym because they were like stories that he didn't really believe in, or books that he was just writing for a paycheck. It wasn't like that. It was that he was writing so many books and he had so many ideas that his publishers were like, dude, you got to cool it. Like, you're saturating the market. And he was essentially competing with himself because his output was so high, but he just wanted to, he just wanted to keep writing and publishing books. So he was like, hey, what if I just do it under a different name? And they went for it.
That's such an interesting thing, because I think I read a little bit about Richard Bachman. I think that was one of the things that that I saw in one of the articles, which was like the conventional wisdom at the time, I guess, was that you couldn't write too much. There was a point where you couldn't write. If you were publishing too much under one author's name, then it would lead to diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm.
But that's clearly not the case anymore, because you do have these authors who write these novels or have their name on novels or write outlines for like 10 books a year, and they have like a team of ghostwriters that puts them out, so they every month they almost they can have another book out. I just said 10. I said 10 a year, and then I said every month. Between 10 and 12 books a year, we'll say. I'm sorry. I'm very tired today.
you're the dark half is starting to take over.
Yeah, except it's just the part that makes, except the dark half isn't the part of me that commits random murders. It's just the part of me that gets really tired at 8 o'clock.
So this is the interesting thing about this. He lives with this dark half like his whole life, basically. And then for a while it goes away, and then he decides he's going to like retire the pseudonym. He's going to kill it off, which interestingly is what Stephen King did with Richard Bachman. I think that they had like a fake, like they faked his death or something. But he comes back and he just starts killing people. And it's just weird to me that like, he wouldn't do that. He seems like the type of entity that would just always be killing people. You know what I mean? Like his whole life.
Mm.
But for some reason, like he just now decides that he wants to become a murderer. Like this at this point, when Thad Beaumont is like trying to retire him, it's just, I don't know. It's very odd to me, the dynamic with George Stark and his motivations of just murdering everybody.
Yeah.
It's like, to what end, you know? Like,
yeah, it's not really adequately explained, or maybe it is, but it's just so convoluted in this movie that is at least 15 minutes too long that it just never actually proves itself to us, to the viewer, to the audience, to itself.
At one point, there's this really great, and it's towards the beginning too, I believe. It's definitely in like maybe the first act, where he has this like dream, and it's like this kind of surreal vision where there's this like chicken in an oven, and it's like skin peels off, and then there's this like ceramic like model model of his wife. And it like shatters, and like there's a skeleton underneath. And that scene was so cool. And I just wanted the whole movie to be like that. And it's not at all. Like, you have this one great like nightmare scene that when you look at the movie as a whole, that scene was completely insignificant and didn't need to exist. But at the same time, that's the one scene that I'll probably remember in this whole stupid movie.
Yeah, there are these great individual images and sequences that just really, you're like, I want more of this. But like, and I feel that way again whenever we get to any business with all the sparrows.
Yeah, there's a great scene with the sparrows towards the end when they're like busting through the wall. Like that looked really cool. And then the final scene when the sparrows eat up George Stark, and they're like going through, they like pecked his skull open, and they're like flying through his skull. Like, that was great.
Again,
the effects work in this movie is top notch. It's just that there's not that many great scenes that use it. Most of it's just boring ass Timothy Hutton doing nothing, protecting no one either. He doesn't protect anybody. He knows exactly who's going to get killed, and yet he does nothing to stop it.
Yeah. feels like what we come to expect at the after a point.
Also, his, the alter ego is hit ridiculous with the slicked back hair.
Yeah, leather, it's not. It's very. I was looking for more information about this movie. I found this art. Apparently, and I wonder if this might have led to maybe this movie kind of getting maybe having problems with editing. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what happened here, which is that. They finished shooting it in early 91, but it sat on the shelf for 2 years because it was an Orion production and Orion was having a lot of financial troubles then.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't go out until 93. I wonder if it just got stuck on a shelf during that period.
Yeah, maybe it was one of those deals where it was, they just like pooped it out.
They released like a not finished, like a not a fully finished cut of it. Yeah. it had the time code still on it. That explains the number of the five shots in this movie that start with the guy hitting the clapperboard. I thought that was weird.
That and the timestamps and the placeholder music too, which is kind of odd. Mm-hmm. Oh god. Yeah, this one I was excited because this was a King one. It was directed by Romero. Never saw it before, but man, I was not missing out on anything.
No, you're not missing out on 2 hours and 1 minute worth of it.
Yep. All right. Yeah, that's the dark half. I would actually avoid that one. That one's not. No good. No good. Our final entry this month is The Mangler.
Oh, the Mangler.
This is directed by Toby Hooper, the one and only Toby Hooper. It came out in 1995. I remember back in the day, there was this CD store, this music store that I would frequent. And for whatever reason, they would sell screeners. And I know that that's like a huge no-no. Yeah.
They shouldn't be. But they sold
screeners. And I remember seeing that they had a screener for The Mangler, and I didn't buy it or anything. I never bought a screener there, but yeah, The Mangler. I have a synopsis here. A laundry folding machine has been possessed by a demon, causing it to develop homicidal tendencies. Now, if that doesn't get you going, I don't know what. Like, that should be enough for you to seek out The Mangler.
I should clarify my earlier statement around, I guess, when we were finishing up talking about Misery, that I was just going to have less and less to say from here on out. That's a qualifier. It was going to go down, but then it was going to come back up because now we're talking about The Mangler.
They made two sequels to this, and I really wanted to watch them, but I just didn't have enough time.
I was hoping you would have seen them because.
Well, the thing is, like, I couldn't, I couldn't easily find The Mangler 2. Like, I think I would have had to buy that on DVD. And The Mangler Reborn, which is the third one, that's on Tubi. And I think it's on Amazon Prime too. But I didn't want to watch the third one without this watching the second one first, even though I know that they really don't have anything to do with each other than The Mangler, I would imagine.
You didn't want to miss any of the Mangler lore.
Yeah. I just want to see what that crazy Mangle is up to.
Yeah.
So this is the second time I've seen this movie. I actually watched this one not too long ago as well. Probably maybe three years ago or something. I probably have it logged in Letterboxd, but this is a movie that's interesting because when you first put it on, you don't immediately think, oh, this is a Stephen King. Like, it doesn't immediately have that sort of vibe, but after a few minutes, I think that it does. I think that it still has that, specifically in Ted Levine's character. I think that his character encompasses that sort of King vibe.
Oh, definitely.
And I don't know. What did you think of The Mangler?
I think it's a movie that is interesting in a few different ways, but never fully maybe works as a movie, you know, from start to finish. It probably is much like The Dark Half, a case of a movie that's about 15 minutes too long.
Yeah.
Like, the you do not need an, what is it? It's like an hour 50 or something. You do not need almost 2 hours of The Mangler. Like, 90...
yeah,
90 minutes is enough.
It's you know, we know what it, we know what's going on here. Like, this is, it's a laundry folding machine that kills people. Like, it's a giant laundry folding machine that kills people. That's what it is.
And when it kills people, it kills people.
Oh yeah. It, I mean, imagine what that would do to someone.
What do you, I mean, yeah. Apparently this was like based on a really early Stephen King story, like early 70s pre-Carrie.
Mm.
So maybe if it's generally accurate to the tone of the story, that might be why it doesn't feel quite so Stephen King, because this would have been very early.
Yeah, and also this feels like, I don't know, this could have been a novel. Was it a short story. Yeah, it feels like this would have been a short story, because there's just not a lot here. You have someone who gets killed by a laundry folding machine, and then Ted Levine plays a detective, and he's, like, investigating it. And then you have Robert Englund, who is, like, the owner of the laundry factory where this machine is. And he is just such a cartoon character in this. I was not into his portrayal of Bill Gartley at all. Like, I feel like he cheapened the whole movie by,
I mean, even that name, like Gartley, there's just something.
There's a really great scene though involving him when he's like berating that woman. Was it his niece or somebody, but there's this scene when he's like yelling at her and the camera's just like spinning around them, doing like, you know, 360 around them, and that looked really great. I think that there's some really interesting camera work in this movie, but the problem is the lighting is horrible. Like, and by that I don't mean like the lighting itself, like, because there's a lot of really good shadows, reflections, and all of that stuff here, but it's so dark. This movie is so dark. I mean, it's not like Relic dark or anything, but. Was it Relic? Is that the one?
Yeah. Any movie by Peter Hyams.
Yeah. It wasn't like End of Days or Relic or any one of those where it was like completely pitch black, but it was very hard to see what was going on in this movie, at least for me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I get it. There are a lot of bad lighting choices in this movie. Also, I feel like I need to expand. On my criticism of the Robert Englund character's name, like Bill Gartley, because on that sounds like a name a person could have, but I think basically every character in this movie has a name that once you put them all together, they don't sound like real names.
Yeah,
like Ted Levine is John Hunton.
Mm-hmm.
It's like then there's the foreman George Stanner. That's kind of a name. The
Sherry Ouellette.
Yeah, there's just something like those three, like Bill Gartley and John Hunton and Sherry Ouellette, like in the possibility that someone listening to this has a name like this or knows someone else name like this. I'm not saying that there's a problem with your name. I'm just saying somehow these three, like some of these characters with their names listed together, there's something not right. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
I loved some of the production design on this movie. There's this really great scene that takes place in a hospital, and there's this like fish. They use this like fisheye lens to show the like hospital waiting area, and it looks awesome. Like, so, and I like the look of the factory in and of itself as well. It's a very like oppressive. Like it feels hot. Like you can feel the heat of this place. So I think that there's some really interesting camera work, interesting cinematography. I think the production design is way better than it needs to be, like way better than a movie called The Mangler would be. Like you wouldn't expect it to have like decent elements. the story itself, I think, is average. Nothing really spectacular here. But there's some really great, like the ending is pretty bonkers. And
oh my goodness.
Like the ending is not what you would really expect. It definitely takes a turn at some point and it just kind of goes off the rails.
It should not. Like, it's, if we're talking about where this movie needs to be shorter, the ending goes on for a bit.
Yeah. And there's some glorious 90s CG.
Oh, is there?
In that ending, too. So, yeah, this one, again, not a good movie, but I had fun with it. I had way more fun with this one than Sleepwalkers and The Dark Half, I think. Like, you know, as far as, like, the King canon, the King film universe goes, this is near the, you know, on the lower half, but it's still, I think, an interesting one.
I mean, there's some... It's hard to deny the moments where this movie, like, works pretty well. I mean, there is some discussion that I encountered in kind of my cursory research on The Mangler, and almost all of it, above a certain level of just... if we're going to talk about The Mangler as a story, then I think... It seems like there's a pretty good consensus that you can, pretty self-evidently if you've seen it, use this as, say, this is a statement on capitalism.
Oh yeah, I mean, just
it's very much. Yeah, it's, I mean, like, it's in a factory. It's about
you replace this factory with an Amazon warehouse, and
yeah,
there you have it. Like, that's,
it's like the fundamental idea. It's literally about the factory owners, like, using, like, the literal, like, killing, like, the deaths of the, and the blood of the workers, yeah, are necessary to keep the factory, the machines, keep it working.
Fed. Keep the machine fed.
Yeah.
Fold that laundry. It seems like a very elaborate piece of machinery just to fold laundry too, but yeah, what do I know?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like this feels like something.
I think it is real. Yeah. Like, I think it's a real machine.
I mean, really that big, but
yeah, like, I don't know about the one that we saw in the movie, but I think it is based off of, like, an actual machine, and there is the piece is called the Mangle, and that's where the term the Mangler comes from, mm-hmm. because the Mangle mangles you up.
Yes, it does.
So yeah, I don't know. I would give this one a light recommend. I would say it's worth a look. I don't know about the sequels. I imagine they're horrible, but this one, at least, I would say give it a look. It's very dark and it's overly long and some of it is stupid, but
when it works, it works.
It's still pretty fun. And
make
note of that really great fisheye lens scene in the hospital, because I think everybody will like that shot. Anything else you wanted to add about The Mangler? Or just any of these King films in general.
I think that's about it.
Yeah, this was kind of an interesting set where the directors were kind of note, but the movies themselves didn't always work in this case. And of course, we could have picked some other one, like maybe higher profile ones, but I was happy to have at least two on the list that I didn't see. Oh, so
isn't it more fun to talk about the Mangler in a certain way?
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, there's other ones that we could have talked about. Like, if we really wanted to, we could talk about, like, The Shawshank Redemption, even though it's not, like, a horror movie. It's still a Stephen King story. Yeah. And we'll likely talk about Shawshank at some point, just because I think we have to. But
it feels inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not looking forward to it. I'm one of the few people who actually doesn't really like that movie.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we will probably get around to it someday.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
Yeah, I don't really have an opinion on it.
All right. Well, maybe you will at some point when we talk about it. Yeah, let us know what your favorite Stephen King adaptations are. It doesn't have to just be the 90s. Just let us know what your general favorite King adaptations are, because man, I like almost everything. Even like even the newer stuff, I think, like Gerald's Game was really good. I was surprised at how good that one was. It had a lot. It definitely had some Misery vibes to it.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. I was trying to figure out if I.
It's another one about someone trapped in a bed and has
quite a
climax. All right. I think that's going to be it for this month. Thank you so much for tuning in. You can send us your 90s memories to 90s@filmpulse.net or by DMing us on Facebook or Twitter at 90s Pod. Also, if you get a moment, consider reviewing us on iTunes. That'd be great. Until next month, for Ken Bakley, my name's Adam Patterson. This has been Saved by the 90s.
Bye, everyone.